The shelves in the nonfiction section of your local bookshop probably groan under the weight of texts about a rising China. Most of them will take a top-down view of the country's booming economy, or of its murky politics, or Deng Xiaoping's economic revolution of the 80s, or China's plans for the world. Far fewer are the books that look at China from the bottom, the woman running a dating website, the cultish English language guru teacher, the auction house owner who knows how to bribe a judge. Evan Osnos gives us that view of China in Age of Ambition, Chasing Fortune, Truth, and Faith in the New China, published by Farrar, Straus, and Giroux. These are the stories he witnessed over years in the country, reporting for the Chicago Tribune and the New Yorker. They're a more subtle view, a balance, as he puts it, of the dark and the light of a country that has unleashed 1.5 billion ambitions that it is simultaneously trying to control. Welcome to this episode of the Lionel Gelber Podcast. We're chatting with five authors whose works are shortlisted for the 2015 Lionel Gelber Prize for Best Book in International Relations. The prize is sponsored by the Lionel Gelber Foundation and the Monk School of Global Affairs in the University of Toronto in partnership with Foreign Policy Magazine. I'm Rob Steiner. Evan Osnos is a staff writer for The New Yorker. He's currently based in Washington, D.C. Evan, welcome.
Thanks, Rob.
So when I told my 14-year-old son, that I was going to be chatting with you and he'd see me reading your book over the course of a couple of weeks, and I had encouraged him actually to read it as a great sort of intro to China, I asked him, what do you know about China? And his one answer was, it's communist, which sort of prompted the question for me, what does communism actually mean in China now as a way to get into the conversation?
Well, it's a good question. I think a lot of people would have answered the question in some ways the way your son did, which is that it remains the dominant fact about China in our time, the idea of the hammer and sickle on the flag. And we just got news, for instance, the other day that they're going to have an enormous military parade this fall, which is the kind of artifact that we don't really think of very much in the world anymore. We don't, the idea of goose-stepping soldiers and tanks moving down the main street of a city just seems like such a throwback. I think it's hard for us sometimes to figure out, well, what does it really mean? The answer, though, actually, and this is a surprise, perhaps, because I wouldn't have answered this way 2 years ago, is that communism as a political idea is, in its own way, more confident today in China than it was even a few years ago. The president of the country, Xi Jinping, is an orthodox communist, and he would completely agree with that description, meaning that he really does fundamentally believe in the ideas of Marxist-Leninism, that you should have a centralized political elite that represents the views and the interests of the people, even when the people are so oppressed, and I put those words in quotes, that they don't even really understand what their interests are, and therefore the elite needs to lead them.
The revolutionary vanguard in the old days,
Yeah, exactly. What it doesn't mean anymore is an economic philosophy about some kind of imposed egalitarianism and, everybody working in collective farms and collective factories. That was a total failure. It was an abject catastrophe for China. And so China basically walked away from the economics of communism and socialism in the late 1970s, but they have held fast emphatically to communism as a political idea.
So how does that make it any different than run-of-the-mill dictatorship or maybe a junta, but with a slightly larger elite? I mean, communism without the economic idea, not that the economic idea was ever great, but communism without the economic idea, isn't that just dictatorship?
Well, there are places that there are dictatorships all around the world that don't call themselves communist, but in some ways pattern themselves after the archetypal one-party state, which was the state that Lenin imagined. I mean, I spent a lot of time in Burma a few years ago, right at the moment when it was trying to begin this transition to democracy, and there wasn't, and that's very much a transition that's still going on, but they didn't have an animating ideology, really, that they were operating from. The junta that existed before was really just a military government that had stayed in power. In China, there is a sense of being part of a political philosophy that goes back to Karl Marx. And You know, there are a lot of people in China today who would say to you, I'm a member of the Communist Party, not because I really care about Karl Marx, but because it's professionally advantageous for me. It gets me a chance to get a job that I wouldn't be able to get otherwise. It's kind of like a professional network.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, it is, I think it's very much an open question about whether the Communist Party as a political entity will still organize itself around the political concepts of communism in 15 or 20 years, or whether it'll say, look, all we care about is maintaining our primacy in political life. All we care about is really running the country. So we'll go in whatever direction is required to do that.
So having said that the book is really a bottom-up view of China, which it is, let's actually switch the question around. How should we understand what freedom now means in China?
It's a moving target. And, you know, I say that partly because I just came back from a couple weeks in China, and I lived there for 8 years. And in the course of that period, we watched this process of this constant ups and downs where people would gain a little bit more freedom in their lives, meaning, for instance, all of a sudden it would become easier to start a business, or it would become a little bit easier to file a case in court if you were a public interest lawyer and you were trying to you know, help a kind of marginalized subculture try to get greater rights, like migrants, for instance. And you would always see this up and down. But I have to say that recently, over the course of the last year, and I certainly saw that on display the other day, this is a down moment. This is a period when that realm of freedom has narrowed. So what you have today is freedom in China really is the realm of private life. It's the ability to decide who you're going to marry, for instance, and just to a certain degree, where you're going to live and what kind of house you're going to buy. And also, you know, up until, this has been curbed a little bit, but up until recently, it was about in what particularly extravagant ways were you going to break the law, for instance, because there really wasn't anything to stop. That's the government's trying to bring some of that quote-unquote freedom under control, whether it's the legal kind or the illegal kind. And so I think we're watching this process of them trying to define the boundaries of what does it mean to be free in an authoritarian society.
So when you say we're in a down moment, describe that. What were you seeing there that tells you this was down? Why are we in a down moment in China now?
Well, I mean, on the most basic level, a number of the people who I think I and a lot of others thought of as activists who operated within the legal framework. These were people who think of themselves as being loyal opposition. These are not dissidents who put themselves squarely outside the system. A number of them have been arrested over the course of the last 18 months. A case in point would be a guy named Su Juryong, who's a lawyer who served in the local legislature in the city of Beijing, for instance, in the kind of municipal council. He started saying, there's corruption and I'm trying to draw attention to it. And the government said, thank you very much, but that's our job. We'll draw attention to corruption. And he stayed at it, kept at it, and he was locked up, and now he's in jail. So there are a number of cases like that that make people who have observed the country over a long period of time, over the last, you know, I guess I got interested in China 20 years ago as of last year. So this is a period where we're at the bottom end of the curve. I've seen it happen enough that I believe that at some point it's going to also begin to move in a more open direction, where they're going to realize, you know, the more we clamp down on people, the more pressure builds up, the fewer sort of pressure releases, safety valves there are, and so they have to create a little bit more room again.
What's prompting it right now? Is it fears of, you know, overflow from the Umbrella Revolution in Hong Kong? Is it the campaign against corruption? What is it? The fact that there's a new president, or?
Yeah, it's all of the above, but I would say that the most important factors are that you've got a president who's now 2 years into office, Xi Jinping, meaning he's still in the process of consolidating his power, which is one of those kind of vague words. What it really means is that he is lining up the people who support him, and he's either locking up or sufficiently intimidating his opponents so that they won't stand in the way of his rule. That's one piece of it. So that means that he needs to project an image of authority. Another big factor in this, and I think you really have to put an emphasis on this, is not so much the Umbrella Revolution in Hong Kong, which was a manifestation of this kind of pressure, But really, it was about the color revolutions that began in Europe almost a decade ago, and we see them. We see that same combination of technology and political organization reflected all the way through the Arab Spring. And what you see, and if you look at sort of the way that the Communist Party talks to itself, so its internal communications and the kinds of language that it uses to talk about politics, it's acutely afraid of that phenomenon coming home onto Chinese soil. And so it hasn't figured out exactly how to deal with the internet. So as a result, it's kind of clamping down on the internet. And so it's a combination of those factors, but it creates a real sense of political insecurity among the leadership.
But I have to say, you know, when I, as I read your book, and it almost feels like, you know, it's interesting, you know, China for anyone who's watched it or lived there, been close to it or from there, is this amazing combination of both eternal and constantly changing. It's a synthesis that almost doesn't reproduce itself in the patterns of Western history or Western progress. But and I sense that in this conversation here. But as I read your book, which I suppose is based on reporting over the last 8 years, I almost got the sense that the spirit of Tiananmen is over. It's sort of dead. I mean, Ai Weiwei arrested. You have a whole passage in the book about the impacts of that on China. And it was remarkable to see how many folks, including the dissident community, were sort of saying, you know what, maybe he sort of asked for it and maybe we should all just calm down a little bit. And I thought, boy, that thing seemed to have gone a long way since Tiananmen in 89. So
I think that the legacy of Tiananmen Square is very important and actually very distinct. I think it's in the background of Chinese life today, exactly as you said, in the way that, for instance, if you're a kid growing up in school, you probably don't know anything about it from you certainly know nothing about it from your formal school curriculum. You know, the events at Tiananmen Square, the crackdown at Tiananmen Square is essentially described as, in very vague terms, as a counter-revolutionary uprising that was put down successfully and therefore protecting China's rise. And that's more or less what you get from your formal studies. But if you go online and you do a little bit of tooling around and you get around the Great Firewall, which is very hard for anybody under the age of 20, what you discover is that there is this whole alternative set of information that you haven't had access to. And there was a guy who I write about in the book named Han Han, charismatic young blogger who generated a huge following, became the most popular blogger in the world for a while. And he said to me, you know, there's this strange effect that when you put something out of view, censor it, all of a sudden my natural human instinct is to say, well, what else are you keeping from me? What else am I not able to see? So in some ways, the spirit of Tiananmen Square, which was this moment of challenging the leadership of the Communist Party and saying we demand a greater right of self-determination, people learned the negative lesson from that, which was that it's a very, very risky thing to do, and it can probably make your life a lot harder than you want it to be. But it didn't eliminate that impulse. If anything, I think it drove that impulse underground. But the Chinese people, over the course of history, have shown themselves to be incredibly irascible, and they will not, in the end, permit a system for too long that doesn't give them the full expression of their abilities. And I think that's the crisis that the party is facing today. Is how do you allow this incredibly dynamic society that they've really unleashed, how do you allow it to continue to grow and expand and evolve?
So I want to step away actually then from the politics, use that as a bit of a segue into some of the sociology of what you're describing here around all of these different kinds of ambitions that have been unleashed. And as I read the book, I almost categorize them into different chunks. There are folks with economic ambitions that have been unleashed, you know, who just want to become rich. There are folks with their political ambitions who become unleashed, as we've talked about here. And then just folks who, sorry, in terms of their lifestyle and their values. Excuse me. Want to actually live richer lives, see more of the world. Was it your sense that, you know, these were different tribes, folks sort of chose which kind of freedom they actually wanted to pursue, or that all these things coexist in the same people at the same time?
Yeah, it's an interesting way to put it. I totally agree with you. I think of them as these little subcultures, and in many ways, it's a period in China now where people go shop for different identities, and they try them on for a little while and then try something else. I'll give you a good case of that, was a guy I came to know when I moved to China a number of years ago, was a terrific Chinese journalist named Lin Gu, who had basically grown up in a family that didn't really have anything to do with journalism, but he just got absolutely seized by what was suddenly possible, what this idea that he could go out and pursue stories and write them as ambitiously as he wanted to. I mean, artistically and stylistically. Look, there were huge limits on what he could say politically, and kind of accepted that. He was just excited about what it meant to be in this profession. And he was at it for a few years and was quite good at it. And then, so his world was the journalism world. And then I kind of lost track of him. And I asked some friends once, I said, what happened to Lin Gu? And they said, oh, you didn't hear, he became a hermit. And I said, what do you mean he became a hermit? And then I emailed him. And sure enough, I guess, you know, the hermit had email. And Lin Gu, I said, what's up? And he said, let's get together. And we, the next time he came back to the city, we met at a subway station near my house. And sure enough, he had a shaved head and he was wearing brown cotton robes. And we went and sat down and just had a fascinating conversation about this turn in his life. And he had basically become a Buddhist. He'd sort of embarked on this totally new form of ambition, which was a kind of spiritual quest. And for him, he explained it quite simply and clearly, I thought. He said, look, I tried for years to find the truth as I pursued it in journalism, as I understood it, and it was unsatisfying because of the limits of what I can do in this country because of censorship. And now I'm trying to find the answers in another way. And I think you find versions of that rippling all over Chinese
society. Wow. And it speaks actually to that dimension of freedom that you're talking about, that at a personal level, you actually have a range of choice now that you didn't before. There's a piece also that struck me as I was reading. You know, one is so used these days to reading, of course, through all sorts of different cultures that are transforming. And one of the main issues that they're facing is changing gender relations and opening new opportunities for women and so on. But it struck me as I was reading your book that China seems way ahead of the rest of the world. I mean, you have two of the sort of heroes, at least two of the heroes that you're describing in this, in your book, the founder of China's most independent newspaper is a woman, the founder of a dating website, a woman. Guys are looking for women on that dating website who have graduate degrees. Is there, does it feel as an American when you're there that gender discrimination is sort of on a whole different plane than it is in North America, that they figured something out?
Well, there's good news and there's bad news. I totally agree with you. I sort of zeroed in on that phenomenon accidentally, just because I was, you know, over the course of a number of years writing about the most interesting people I could hear about and encountered. And in many, many cases, these were women who were doing fascinating things. So for instance, Hu Shuli, who was this really dynamic investigative editor that you mentioned, or Gong Haiyan, who started this dating website in order to help people suddenly confront the end of the matchmaking era. All of a sudden, I had to figure out who it was they wanted to settle down with. In some ways, the business world is a realm in which Chinese women have been able to make some headway and been able to start businesses. But that's partly because actually the Chinese political realm remains almost exclusively male at the top level. And so as a result, if you're a really well-educated, really ambitious woman in China, there is a limit to what you're going to be able to do politically. If you just look at the Chinese Politburo, for instance, or you look at the Standing Committee of Politburo, it's all men. And if you look at the breakdown of the men and women in the Central Committee, it's radically disproportionate. So what's interesting about that is that the Chinese political traditions haven't caught up to the evolution of society. And so there are ways that women can manage to make a huge imprint on Chinese life by doing it in business, for instance, or in the media, that they can't do it in politics.
I just want to wrap up with the broader view that you take in it. I think it's somewhere right in the middle of the book. And you note sort of quite poignantly that foreign reporters in China often struggle to balance their coverage of the dark side of that country with the light side of that country, and come under criticism whichever side they end up reporting on any given day. How did you strike that balance for yourself?
It's a puzzle. I really faced this question a lot, which was, if I was going to decide what to write about on any given day, should I be writing about somebody who is building a world within this realm of freedom that they've been able to carve out for themselves and, you know, taking advantage of these new opportunities? Or should I frankly write about a dissident who is suffering enormous persecution for trying to do things that are technically protected by the Chinese Constitution? Because both of those phenomena coexist, and they are both real, and they both, neither one is a sort of disservice to the reality of China. And in the end, it's particular, I gotta say, it's particularly hard when you write at the New Yorker, where I do, because I basically write four or five very long pieces a year. And so when you're deciding how you're going to spend the next 2 or 3 months, you really have to be sure that it's a faithful or a fair representation of society. And what I concluded in the end was that there's just no question that we have a responsibility to write about people who are dissident, people who are unable to participate in the Chinese political system in ways that their own laws really should allow them to. And there's the reason for that is that we learn a lot about China and its future and its relationship with other countries and its political character, its kind of moral character, by understanding how it deals with the people who the system doesn't agree with. I mean, it's the same thing we learn about our own societies when we find out, well, how do we deal with people who are outsiders? And so I really had struggled with this, but in the end decided there's just absolutely no question. In fact, it's not even no question. It's a responsibility, particularly as foreign media, because there are things that we can write about that the Chinese press can't write about. And for that reason, we have a responsibility to try to produce a fully rounded picture.
And the book is a fully rounded picture because it's about that, and there's a lot of that, and it's also about that personal space of freedom that they've created. I thank you very much for it. It was a great read and just an amazing introduction to China as it is right now. Evan Osnos is the author of Age of Ambition, Chasing Fortune, Truth, and Faith in the New China. It's published by Farrar, Straus & Giroux. Evan, thank you for joining us.
Thanks, Rob. I enjoyed that.
If you would like to hear more from the Lionel Gelber podcast series, we have discussions with 5 leading authors on international affairs this year, along with more than 25 others from the last 3 years. You can find them all on iTunes by searching for Lionel Gelber, that's G-E-L-B-E-R, or online at monkschool.utoronto.ca, that's monk is N-U-N-K, school.utoronto.ca/Gelber. I'm Rob Steiner, director of the Monk School's Fellowships in Global Journalism. Thank you for joining us.